Good afternoon and welcome to the regular briefing by the Baker Polito administration for the municipal chief executive officers of Massachusetts regarding COVID-19 in the combined state local partnership to deal with the pandemic and work together. We are offering now, I believe it's our 26th municipal CEO briefing of the pandemic era. And the Massachusetts Municipal Association, and again, I'm Jeff Beckwith, the executive director, the Massachusetts Municipal Association cannot express strongly enough how much we appreciate all of the work and the leadership of the governor and lieutenant governor and the entire administration in working arm in arm, shoulder to shoulder with local officials throughout what has been one of the most stressful and trying times in not political history, not governmental history, but in terms of Massachusetts and our economy. And we're doing, I think, as well as possibly can be expected as a result of the leadership of this administration. So this briefing has the governor joining us for the first about half an hour. He is on the phone and will address us, and the lieutenant governor will. As usual, then we'll take some questions as time allows via the chat function. We'll also have a briefing from Secretary Keneally on economic development initiatives by the administration to provide resources to rebuild our economy during the pandemic and the recovery period. And then we'll be available, the administration will have officials available to answer other questions as well during the briefing. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the program over to Governor Baker, who is providing extraordinary leadership for all of us. Governor Baker, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeff. And obviously, I know I speak for the Lieutenant Governor and the rest of our team when I say how difficult we know this has been for us, and therefore we know how difficult it has been for you and for your teams. I think a lot about the conversations I had last spring with first responders and EMTs as they were dealing with sort of the height of the pandemic. And honestly, the grit and the determination and the willingness to really, you know, put yourself out there, that we saw over and over again at the municipal level as people were dealing with this stuff on the ground was extraordinary. And I talked to a lot of my colleagues in local government who said, you know, the work of local government, the traditional work was sort of, I wouldn't call it pushed aside, but sort of deprioritized for, you know, 2-3 months during that whole period when people were just dealing with the onslaught of everything that came with the initial attack, I guess I would call it, from COVID. And a lot of local communities gave us a lot of advice and a lot of guidance around things like PPE and the Lieutenant Governor and Secretary Keneally's reopening advisory board and, you know, how you could do this or how this might work and what's possible here and what do you think about this? And one of the programs I think we're most proud of that came out of all that was the Shared Streets program, which was kind of a idea that came out of DOT after a whole series of conversations with local officials about things that might make their downtowns a little more interesting, a little more attractive. And obviously, municipal governments and its leaders played a huge role in helping us frame both our economic development plan, which we filed with the legislature before all this began, and the most recent economic recovery plan that Secretary Keneally is going to talk about in a while. I mean, a lot of that stuff comes directly out of the conversations and the dialogue that we all have with you on a regular basis. With respect to COVID generally, what I would say right now is that, the second surge that so many of the folks in the public health community talked about last summer, which now seems like a million years ago, is certainly underway, not just here, but across the U.S. and frankly, across almost all the Western democracies. And I think what I would say about it at this point in time is while it is challenging and difficult, the U.S. is doing as well or better than many of our counterparts in Europe And once you get outside Europe, it's kind of hard to tell what some of the, where the reality really lies when you get into some of the other countries that don't necessarily report the same way we and the Europeans do. But South America obviously has huge issues with COVID right now, and Canada does as well, although Canada benefits to some extent from the fact that it's pretty distributed. And if I've learned anything about this virus since the beginning, its population density is a big deal in the context of how it spreads. But we were, as we said at the time, you know, weeks ago, in a much better place to deal with it than we had been. You know, we have enough PPE to last most of the folks we supplied last spring with PPE through the calendar year 2021. And that includes a ton of masks, which I know was a big issue last spring. We also have one of the most robust testing programs in the country. And I would just point out that yesterday, for the first time since the beginning of the pandemic, we reported over 100,000 tests conducted and processed in one day. That is, you know, that's up from 2,000 or 3,000 tests a day back in March and maybe 10,000 tests a day in April and May of last year. So we are in a position where we are testing at the, usually we're either first or second in the country on a per capita basis, depending upon what day it is and what's going on in New York or Rhode Island. Those are really our only competitors with respect to our level of testing. And I'll tell you something, you look at what a lot of states are testing at, many of them are testing at a per capita rate that's literally like half of where we are. And I worry a lot that those folks have a lot of cases they just don't know about. And I think one of the things we've gotten out of our testing protocols is a much better understanding about where the virus is, which has showed up in a lot of our reporting. The other thing I'd mention is we do have, based on all the surveys that have been done, one of the highest compliance rates with masks and hygiene and distance, all that stuff, in what I would call formal places and spaces, which relate to things like work, public buildings, regulated, licensed, inspected recreational activities, all that, entertainment venues, all that stuff. The biggest challenge I think we have, and this has been true in many other places as well, is getting people to take this stuff seriously when they're not in one of those places and to continue to rely on face coverings and distance to keep them from spreading the virus. You combine that with the fact that the average age of the people who are getting the virus has dropped over the course of time since last spring, and you know, who have mild symptoms, or in some cases, no symptoms at all, but they're still contagious. And that's one of the reasons why we've been so aggressive about saying you really need to wear your mask whenever you're with people who aren't part of your network. And I get the fact that for a lot of people, we've been saying that for a long time, but it is in many respects one of the great, it is the single greatest weapon we have in slowing and stopping the transmission of COVID. We've talked before about some of the issues and concerns we have about the way people do or don't choose to abide by the rules. I think the two best examples that have shown up lately in our contact tracing efforts are some of the issues around houses of worship, which in some cases involves houses of worship that weren't even being used for worship purposes, but were just being used because the gathering orders that are in place did not really seem to apply to them. And we had a horrible, not horrible, that's too strong a word, a really unfortunate series of events that took place in Fitchburg, where a whole bunch of people used church facilities for a bunch of meetings and gatherings, and literally hundreds of people got infected, and that has translated into a huge pop in hospitalizations in Central Mass. I think people are also familiar with the clusters that came out of some epidemiological work we did around hockey. We're continuing to talk to the hockey folks about trying to come up with a set of rules that will ensure that at a minimum, everybody's wearing masks when they're attending, participating, and watching or engaging in this activity. And all the rosters are going to be expected to be made available to to the contact tracing folks so folks can chase down the possibility of additional cases and situations and circumstances where folks have tested positive. It was disappointing, I think, to all of us that we were still having the conversation about trying to access rosters, given everything we all know about the spread of COVID and how it works. We've also seen a fairly significant pop, not surprisingly, in our cases over the course of the past 3 months now, going back to Labor Day. We're up about 300% in average daily case counts and about 150% in hospitalization rates. Now, if you look at that number and that sort of rise and you put it up against what happened in the spring, it's very different. I mean, in the spring, it took us a few days to have 150% increase in hospitalizations in the spring. All right. We're talking now about 90 days to have that kind of a climb. So while that climb is significant and it's important and we need to deal with it and adjust to it, we have way more visibility into the runway associated with this thing at this point, because so many people aren't playing by the rules, and it really is not like it was in the spring. But part of the reason we put out the limit on private gatherings and part of the reason we put out the stay-at-home advisory earlier this week was to deal with what we consider to be the two biggest challenges we've got, which is people just not taking seriously, especially as the evening goes on, the issues associated with face coverings and distance and all the rest, and these gatherings of large numbers of people in private residences where there is a lot of, you know, sort of very informal behavior going on is just, it is a big problem if you're trying to manage a contagion. And it's our hope that people will take this stuff seriously. We got a lot of good input from local communities about guidance and clarification, as well as from some of the industries that are involved in this. And I think probably later today, we'll do the best we can to update some of that stuff. And we have heard from a lot of communities that it would help if we could create some, not so much clarification, but some recognition of the fact that small community, you don't need a lot of cases in a small community for a small community to go yellow or red. And we ought to be encouraging communities to test. And there are many communities that, because they're testing, have identified cases, which is a good thing, that they can then work with us and with their own local boards of health to deal with on contact tracing and isolation and that type of thing. But people have said, you know, because there's no reward for testing that's associated with the way we currently measure and monitor what's going on at the community level, we're really not providing communities with the right kind of incentive to test and to test aggressively. And we are incorporating that into our conversations with the command center and the folks at DPH to see if we can come up with some way of incorporating both the small community issue and the testing question, which other states have done, by the way, in terms of how they measure and monitor what's going on either at the county level or the local level. And I'll stop there and turn it over to the LG.
Thanks, Gus. I really appreciate your being on here. I've kept the governor up to date with our conversations. I didn't know we were at 26, Jeff, but these have been very interactive and constructive meetings demonstrating our partnership. And we learned just as much as you do in this exchange. And I know the governor wanted to come on today just to be here to continue to support this partnership and is very grateful for the hard work of all the local officials all across our Commonwealth doing their work every day. And as he started off saying, you know, we've made our programming better because of the things we learned in these conversations, being able to address a specific issue, streamlining programs to make them easy to apply, turning dollars into your hands as quickly as possible has really made a difference, we feel, in our response and our recovery. As the governor noted, You know, we have said all along this journey that we're going to use the data to guide us in our decisions. And with the advice of our medical advisory board and our the healthcare and public health folks around us, make the right decisions at the right time. Now, at a time, at a moment, that might be the right decision, but then as you go along, you have to make adjustments. And I think our agility has been tested time and time again throughout this process. Like, this is one of those moments where we become smarter, we have more data and information, and we've got to make a decision, and we have around what to do so that we don't continue to head in a wrong direction, but we make a correction so we can literally stay on track and keep our economy open and keep our schools active and get as many students as possible into classrooms so that they can have the best learning opportunities in this year of their education. So we worked hard on this package of things that are really needed to address behavior, literally. We know that the workplaces and places that have incorporated all of the protocols are doing a really good job at that. But it's more the behaviors in informal, casual settings that are creating a virus spread in some areas more than others that needs to be, you know, put in check. And we can't do this alone, but we can create the toolkit and the toolbox of things to work with. And we really need your help as local officials to, you know, get compliance, send out the messages, remind people how to behave, and then give you some additional tools to work with, whether it's a fine or an ability to talk to people about these are the rules the governor's laid out, and we really need your help. So as the governor laid out, the stay-at-home advisory from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. is literally an opportunity to say, you know, go to school, go to work, do the things that you need to, but get home early. You know, don't gather with people that you're not normally with, because that will contribute to the virus spread. You know, face covers, we've talked a lot about that in this forum, and we just want people to be in the habit of wearing the face cover when they're out in public. I think in the chat, someone raised the question, do you need to wear the face cover in an office setting? That's an example where you would want to follow the industry-specific protocol for that workplace. And there is a protocol for offices and private settings. So you would follow that protocol. And I think that was from the mayor of Taunton. Gatherings, we know that the indoor private setting gathering is where we're seeing more of the cluster develop. And that's why we've reduced the private indoor gathering size to 10 and 25 outdoors at your private, say, residence. In terms of public places, which is something all of you have to deal with more often, they're in a lower risk community. The indoor size is 25 and outdoor 100. For those who would be gathering outside this time of year and in the upcoming months, that's probably going to be less of a thing. And for non-low risk, it's 25 in and 50 out. And anyone hosting or wishes to host an event in a public place, the event organizer needs to notify your local Board of Health and comply with the contact tracing guidance. So that is something that may become more active in your circles, and we can make sure that you have what you need there. The reopening, you know, I know Secretary Keneally will talk more about recovery, but we obviously monitor the reopening phased-in approach that we had have had. And regarding the 9:30 early close, that was an attempt to balance both the public health needs that we have as well as the economic needs. And we really didn't want to go to a rollback of the phase like you've seen in other states and try to be as reasonable as possible and implement the 9:30 closure for a number of different later in the day kind of activities, whether it's a restaurant or a bowling alley or a movie theater or an indoor performance theater or a gym or a fitness center or a place that you might get a personal service. We're looking to close those services at 9:30. Of course, the workforce in those places can clean up and do what they need to, but really want the public use of those services to end at 9:30 and for people to go home and end their day. As the governor said, the daily dashboard is a very important tool for all of you to look at to see what's happening in your community or in your region. We did a refresh to make sure that the information in that dashboard is telling you something that's important and useful to you. And so the daily information now will include more information around long-term care and college case positives. Also, the results of the contact tracing effort, which is much more expansive today than it was when we first started it. The new category around case growth by age group is also an important data point that many of you want to pay close attention to. And as we have seen, the age category 39 and under is where we're seeing more of the case positives. I think the governor described that. They might be asymptomatic, but they're still infectious, and that's a concern. And it's really a concern as we're facing the Thanksgiving holiday, where you see younger people and older people coming together typically, and really the putting out the guidance around what to do to make it a safer holiday for everyone is an example. Trends, I know Dr. Madoff and his team are on. We're always looking at the data and seeing what trends we can see before it morphs into something much larger. So the data daily dashboard will have data points that address some of that. Test turnaround, that's a question that's come up on this call too. You know, the length of time it takes for a test to show a result so that people can make decisions appropriately around that information. And then of course the positivity rates will be part of that daily dashboard information system. One more point, and then we'll turn it over to your questions. Someone asked about testing and the cost of testing and whether it can be free. I think some of you might have these Stop the Spread sites in your community, but that is the system that we're directing people to for a free test. We have 18 Stop the Spread sites, and they are, you know, the information about them is visible on our website, and that's where you could direct someone to go that is looking for a test, but don't see the other kinds of tests as being affordable to them. With that, I will stop and just say again, thank you, and look forward to our conversation.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor and Governor. We do have a series of questions in the chat function. I know, Governor, you can't see that, but I'm going to pull one out because we have you for a few more minutes, and I know this is a question that is near and dear to you and that you feel very passionate about, and it has to do with schools. And as you take a look at all of the data regarding school closure from last year and whether or not schools can safely reopen, you have been advising folks to, as much as possible, reopen schools and have as much in-person teaching as possible and learning as possible. We've had questions come in just regarding whether any guidance is going to be updated or more information provided to municipalities as they make decisions about how to format education going forward during this period of a second increase in infections, but schools not really being a part of that at this time. So, Governor?
Well, I guess I'd say a couple of things. The first is, one of the things we didn't know about with respect to schools last spring was what role they would play in, you know, spreading the virus. We didn't really know much about how it affected kids. And we also didn't know much about masks. And we know a lot more about all of those things now. And we also have a whole bunch of real life experience that's taken place over the course of the past 8 or 9 months. There have been several large longitudinal studies done in Europe involving literally like hundreds of thousands of students and teachers. And if you add them all up, it's millions of students and teachers. And they all basically say the same thing, which is if people wear face coverings and they maintain, you know, appropriate distance, which, you know, is as low as 3 feet in some places and six, as much as six in others, there just isn't much evidence at all that there's much spread there. There's also a fair amount of data that is becoming more and more available about the virus and young people. And when I say young now, I'm talking like under the age of 12. They don't get it with anywhere near the same frequency as people over the age of 12, which means there is a bit of a difference in terms of how people think about K to 8 and K to 5 and how they think about high school. I also think the teaching modalities for high school, and I think most folks in education would agree with this, are different. And it's a different population, which gives you far more flexibility in terms of how you teach and what the pedagogy would be for high schoolers versus the younger kids. And the final group, you know, we never stop teaching in person kids with special needs, right? There are programs that stopped, but there were many that never did, all the way through the spring and the summer, right? And there was very little COVID transmission that was ever tied to those engagements. And again, you know, face coverings and following the rules, there just wasn't much evidence that it was a significant source of transmission or of spread. And I guess what I would say, Jeff, is if people have particular things that they don't believe have been guidance that's been put out by DESE, which they did in conjunction with the American Academy of Pediatrics and a bunch of folks in the public health community starting in like July, then you guys should let us know what the particular questions are that people think they need to answer. There's nothing about, I mean, the numbers, the cases per 100,000 in the UK, in France, in Italy, in Spain, and in Ireland are much higher than the cases per 100,000 in Massachusetts, much higher. And they still have schools open. And the reason, and schools have not proven to be a big source of spread. And the reason they have schools open is because kids need to be educated and they aren't where most of the problem associated with this virus comes from. And they're, you know, they're adhering to pretty strict protocols with respect to face coverings and cohorting and all the rest. But if there's like a particular set of questions that people don't think DESE's answered, you guys should get them to the Lieutenant Governor and me, and we'll make sure that DESE does. But there's a much larger point here that's being missed, I think, which is we now have real world experience in places all over the globe that show that schools with protocols aren't sources of spread. And think about where we are. We have something like 500,000 kids who are currently in some form of hybrid or in-person learning. And I think the reporting numbers coming in from local school districts show the total number of cases between students and staff and faculty to be somewhere in the vicinity of 250 to 300, almost all of which people say didn't come from schools. They've only had a couple of instances, very small, where there have been any even suspicion of transmission that took place in school. So if you do the math on, you know, 250 and And 250 cases, 300 cases, half a million teachers and students in hybrid or in-person learning. I mean, I don't know what more I can say about it. There's just a big body of evidence at this point, along with those longitudinal studies I mentioned, which we can probably get copies of if that would be helpful, but a lot of people have written about them. The issue here is if there's guidance that people need, we're just ask. We'll get it to people. But I think I personally think DESE did a good job on the guidance they put out back in July and August. To me, there's like a good news story here that no one seems to want to acknowledge, which is kids in schools are not anywhere near as worrisome or troubling as all this non-supervised, non-regulated activity that is going on in many cases instead of people going to school, is when it comes to creating and creating clusters and spreading the virus. So I guess what I would say is let us know what those things are that are specifically concerning people, and we'll make sure DESE responds to them.
Thank you, Governor. We will. Although I think that the data that you've been working to produce and have generated in real time, and the information from DESE on the DESE website, is helping a lot of districts and municipal leaders recognize that in this new normal, there are new ways and new ways that we have to move forward. We can't put everything on hold, including schools. So I think that's been extraordinarily helpful. And having you and Lieutenant Governor emphasize this point is critically important for municipal leaders who are working to just allay fears of parents and teachers and just get back into school. And then that in itself is evidence in the community that it can be done and done successfully. So I think your leadership on this is extremely not only helpful, but is providing a pathway for schools to really re-engage in person. I don't know how much longer we have you for.
I will say this. The one thing I will say about sort of what I've heard from, and this is anecdotal, this isn't like I didn't do a survey, but I mean, I talk to a lot of people I know in the education space pretty regularly. If you were to say to me, tier the way, the sense of urgency, the special ed stuff, special needs kids, is by far the highest urgency with respect to what's being lost by not having in-person instruction. And it's probably one of the areas where we have the best and most examples of how it can work and how it can be done in our own state, because it's been going on since, April, successfully in places all over Massachusetts. And that does seem to be where, when kids don't have in-person learning, they really do deteriorate in a big way. And it's an enormous problem. It borders on a tragedy almost. The second group is the K through five, which honestly, you talk to almost anybody who studied this and they'll say that the K through five population will wear masks, will wear face coverings, and are in many respects the hardest population to teach remotely, because they need some of that physical presence when you're trying to teach them to read or spell or almost anything. Math, very, very hard to do that remotely because you can't actually see how kids are progressing online. And they are, in many respects, based on the data that's out there, the least risky population with respect to spread to begin with, in a world and an environment where spread isn't all that prevalent to begin with. The next group is obviously the middle schoolers, and then the final group is the high schoolers. So people have said, look, if the program's robust enough, you can do some things with them, but that are much harder to do with younger kids. But even then, they make clear that they're social animals just like the rest of us, and spending a couple of days a week anyway in school is a good thing for them and a good thing for the people who are teaching them. We talk to Jeff Riley and his team a couple times a week about what they're hearing and where we might be helpful. And I would just say, again, if there are particular things that people think we're leaving, you know, undone, let us know. But the special needs stuff and the younger kids, the data, the impact and the data for both of those populations is pretty clear.
Excellent. Thank you, Governor. And we will make sure to share in real time any questions that are not answered on the DESE website, although I think most are, and share those with you and any other feedback we get. One final question while we still have you is whether or not you and your colleagues in the National Governors Association have heard anything in the last 48 hours regarding the likelihood of any direct aid to states and localities in whatever lame duck session stimulus or relief bill might be cobbled together in the federal level.
So we have a call on this tomorrow, and after we have the call, I will make sure that we report back to you guys on this. It's obviously been, you know, this has been like, you know, one of those old movies, you know, The Perils of Pauline, you know, in and out of tragedy, and then it's all going to work out, and then in and out of tragedy again. I mean, I can tell you that a lot of people in a lot of these conversations said many times, people in Washington said, yep, we're pretty much there, it's going to happen, and then it didn't. And, you know, honestly, part of me doesn't get it, because I do know that on things like K-12 education and higher education, the differences between the House and the Senate and the administration and between Democrats and Republicans are like almost non-existent. I mean, they're all basically in the same place with respect to what they should do there. They're more or less in the same place with respect to what they should do with unemployment insurance. They're more or less in the same place with respect to what they should do with economic development. I mean, you look at there are definitely, people can draw conclusions about where there are differences, and there are. But the flip side of that is there are also huge pieces of this thing where everybody pretty much signed off on the same programmatic approach, and in many cases, more or less the same dollar level in terms of what they're willing to spend. And I've talked to Congressman Neal a lot about this, and I think he's, you know, he was pretty sure they were going to do something a while back. I will check in with him as well. I mean, we should all be incredibly grateful to know that the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee is and will be going forward from Massachusetts. He's a mind-boggling asset in terms of our ability to access legitimate and real information about what's going on and to represent the interests of Massachusetts. He's been incredibly great on a lot of hospital issues. But I will reach out to him as well.
Thank you, Governor. And we just make a note that Congressman Neal is a former mayor and therefore understands local government really well. And so we appreciate his leadership is also.
And if you don't know that he's a former mayor and you drive around Springfield with him, which I've done once or twice, you will learn very fast just how much he knows about both the history, I mean, block by block, he can tell you everything you ever want to know about what's gone on and what did go on and what will go on and what has gone on in Springfield. It's amazing.
That's what local officials do. The same way you could yes, drive people around swamps and tell them. Yeah. Right, exactly, right.
Yep. Hey, I do have to jump, guys, but let me close just by saying how much I appreciate everything you do. And I know we'll be talking, and the Lieutenant Governor and I know we need to clarify a few things in short order on some of this stuff, which we will do.
Thank you,
all
Governor.
Right? That's right. I have to hop, but take care.
Thank you for your partnership and leadership. Thank you. Lieutenant Governor, that's a That's a lot right there. We have a bunch of questions, and we also have Secretary Keneally. So I was thinking maybe what we could do is have Secretary Keneally give a few minutes on the Partnerships for Recovery initiative that the administration has launched, and then we can go through and take as many of those questions as possible for the remainder. How does that sound for you?
Sounds great.
Great. Thank you. Secretary Keneally, thanks for being with us.
Well, Jeff, thanks for having me. Great to be with you all today. And I first want to, I guess, maybe pick up where the governor left off and just thank all the municipal leaders for your incredible partnership throughout this process. As you probably know, I co-chair the Reopening Advisory Board with the Lieutenant Governor, and just the level of partnership and coordination and dialogue with our municipal officials has just been terrific. It's been a quite a moment for all of us, but I think that the level of partnership has been great. And thank you all for all that you are doing in your communities. I'll spend a few minutes on our economic recovery strategy announced now a couple weeks ago on October 22nd. As folks probably know, we released a new economic development plan for the Commonwealth in December of last year. And on the heels of that, the governor filed an economic development bill in early March. And obviously, right after that, the world changed pretty dramatically for all of us. And then we got into the reopening process, took a hard look at our bill, decided we should suggest some changes to the legislature to make it more responsive to the new times we find ourselves in, and in particular, try to address issues of equity and recovery. Happily, that bill has now made it through the House and the Senate and sits in a conference committee, and we're hopeful we'll see some resolution on that one. I think it's contains some really important new tools in our toolbox in the way of capital programs, as well as, very importantly, the governor's housing choice initiative to make it easier to develop more housing. And as we get into the summer months, we realized that it would benefit us to come up with a comprehensive economic recovery strategy. And that's what you saw a couple weeks ago. There's really five things, we call them the recovery imperatives, that we think we have to address. And I'll touch on these briefly and some of the programs behind them. One is support for small business. Obviously, it's been a very challenging time for our smallest companies. And what was announced a couple weeks ago were some new grant opportunities for small businesses, as well as new technical assistance dollars. And I will say, you know, the overall plan is a $774 million plan. And those are dollars that we have available that we intend to spend in this fiscal year, and hopefully as early as possible within that year. And with the exception of $175 million, which was in the governor's budget filed a few weeks ago, the rest of that is money that's at our disposal to spend, including some new funding announced a couple weeks ago, and the small business grants are part of that. So the thought is to have a big impact as soon as we can in this fiscal year. The small business grant money, the applications are available now. They're available up until November 12th. We can get you the link for the application if folks have not found that, but we're encouraging businesses to apply for those grants now. It's $50 million. And the additional technical assistance money will become available soon as well. The need for technical assistance for our smallest companies has been great, obviously, during this period of time. Our Mass Growth Capital Corporation, in conjunction with the MACDC, stood up a COVID stabilization network of 50 entities to provide such assistance. And we're hoping to sort of double down on those efforts, as well as support an existing small business technical assistance program we've had for some years now. So trying to support our smallest companies, both with capital and with assistance. The second area is to support for our downtowns, for our main streets. It's been a tremendously challenging time for our main street companies, as well as our main streets generally in our communities. And so what we have here in new programs are, well, not new in this case, but more money for an existing program, the Shared Streets and Spaces program, which was launched with $10 million. We're providing an additional $10 million for that program. We've gotten great reviews on how communities have used that capital creatively to build out outdoor spaces for dining and commerce. The RFP and that one ought to be out later this month. And then in addition, there are local recovery planning grants and that RFP, so it all should be available later this month. We thought, just as we've spent the time to develop a recovery strategy for the Commonwealth, I bet all of our individual municipal leaders in our cities and towns will want to do the same for their communities. And we think these local recovery planning grants could help in that process. The third part of the strategy is continuing our investments in the innovation economy. And we need to provide relief for our hardest hit businesses, relief for our downtowns. We also have to keep doing the things we're doing to grow the innovation economy here in the state, because that'll be such an important driver of recovery going forward. And I should have said at the outset, you know, that the plan we released is comprehensive of existing programs, new dollars in the budget, and new dollars from the CARES Act. And so it's meant to really highlight all the tools in our toolbox. And as we think about innovation, we talk about the capital programs available with the Mass Life Sciences Center or the Mass Tech Collaborative. And so we will continue to make those investments. And I think that'll be a source of economic recovery going forward. We're very excited about opportunities in life sciences. Being here in a global pandemic with the world's leading life sciences ecosystem, that ought to present some opportunities for us, to say the least. We're very excited about manufacturing. We've had a very dedicated effort around advanced manufacturing for some time. And I think in a global pandemic, as companies start to rethink their supply chains, I think we're going to find ourselves with some interesting manufacturing opportunities here in Massachusetts. I think today our business development pipeline in manufacturing has probably never been stronger. So we'll continue to make our investments there. The fourth item of the plan is simply get people back to work. You know, back in early March, when the governor filed that economic development bill, we had 2.9% unemployment. Unemployment peaked at about 17% over the summer. It's back now in single digits, just under 10%. But we have, we believe, hundreds of thousands of people that are at risk of medium or long-term unemployment. We lost about 1 million jobs at the height of the economic damage in the pandemic. We've added back about half of those. But we're very concerned about that group of people. And they come from industries like restaurants and retail and hospitality that have been particularly challenged. And so I think it's incumbent on us to really find pathways to reskill people and get them into more promising areas for employment. We've had the Workforce Skills Cabinet now since the early days of the Baker-Polito administration. The Secretaries of Economic Development, Education, and Labor. Our mandate back then was to help close skills gaps in what was then a beyond full employment economy, and help find talent in advanced manufacturing and healthcare and IT and the trades, where it was just very hard for anybody to find talent. We had such low unemployment. Well, obviously that's not our mandate now. Our mandate now is to get folks back to work that are unemployed. And we've got some proven programs to do that, as well as some new money we announced a couple weeks ago around additional funding for creative employment partnerships and the Career Technical Initiative, which is was originally announced by the governor in the budget, but it's meant to add more capacity to our vocational technical high schools and community colleges and leverages some work we've done over the last 5 years around capital grants to those programs and helping them build out more creative pathways for their students. And the final item is around housing stability, housing equity, housing opportunity. We've been saying for a long time now, we've been using the term housing crisis, you know, long before we knew what COVID-19 was. Housing's been very, very challenging in Massachusetts for a very long time. We'll continue our investments to create more affordable housing. We'll continue to advocate for the housing choice legislation. We simply need to produce a lot more housing. We'll keep after that. But also as part of this recovery plan is the eviction diversion initiative and trying to make sure we can keep people housed during this very challenging period of time. So that's the recovery plan, support for businesses, Main Streets, workforce, innovation, and housing. And obviously look forward to working with all of you to implement that plan.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. The MMA does have information on your program posted on our website with links to the programs as available because I know that, for example, access to the getting access to the forms for applying for the planning grants and so on. These are questions that local officials are going to want. So want to have answered in terms of where to go and how quickly and what the deadlines are. We'll have that information on our website. I know you have it on yours and the material as well. We're working with your office to have that information posted in real time. Plus, we had the webinar on your the administration's eviction diversion initiative. That's posted on our website along with articles of all those resources as well.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. That's great. Thank you.
So thank you. I know that we're not doing justice to this effort during our 1 hour webinar here, but do want to have time for Lieutenant Governor to address some of the questions that are coming in regarding the overall pandemic as well. So in case people ask questions about the Partnership for Recovery Program or Eviction Diversion Initiative, if you can, are you able to stay with us till the end, Mr. Secretary?
Okay. Yes, I am, yep.
Okay, excellent, so thank you. So now I'll turn it back to the Lieutenant Governor and again, go to the chat function here and see what questions haven't been addressed so far. And we'll see, Lieutenant Governor, how many we can plow through in the remaining 10 minutes. There were some questions about testing. You've answered those regarding free testing sites. Although we did have one question come in regarding free testing where someone brought a minor, their child under 18, to the testing site and was told that they would have to pay for the child to take a test. Do you know if that's correct or was that site misinformed?
I'll let Dr. Medoff say the correct answer on this. But I also wanted to add that there's a mega testing site in Revere. I think it's 24/7. You don't need an appointment. You can go. But Dr. Medoff, can you correct me on exactly the answer to the younger person getting tested and whether they have to pay?
Most of the Stop the Spread sites do handle children down to 12 months of age, and testing should be free for them as for anyone else. I just, the mega testing site, you are supposed to sign up for an appointment. It's an online. Appointments are readily available, though, and it's drive-through, and again, free and down to 12 months of age for any resident of the Commonwealth.
Thank you very much. It's always good to get pithy clarification of these questions. Excellent. The next one, well, first of all, just for folks that aren't able to see the questions on the chat, there are a number of comments just expressing deep appreciation to the administration, Lieutenant Governor, and the governor for the partnership. Also, there are a couple of questions about that, Lieutenant Governor, I think you answered earlier regarding what the mask requirements are inside the office setting for municipal buildings. And there's a request for the link to that particular guidance to be provided. We'll just make sure that in MMA's summary article of this, that of this webinar, that we include the link to the office building guidelines for face coverings and so on.
Let me just say on that, because I'm thinking about my town hall, for instance. So if you're sitting at your desk doing your work, you should follow the office guidance for that. And we can provide that link. If you are then at a counter providing service to a public, you know, a public facing function, say you're at the town clerk's office and someone comes in for business person to person, you would wear a face covering. So we will provide you with the links so that you can share those widely.
Absolutely. And they are on our, they've been posted on our website for a while, but along with about the 800 other links to information we have. So pulling it out and making it more readily available will be helpful. Also, there are a couple of questions regarding the Mass Restaurant Association having sent an email out to their members regarding the time to cut off seating and serving. The order that you announced earlier this week has a 9:30 closure for certain businesses. Can you clarify for local officials how that impacts restaurants and whether or not?
Yes, then we may provide further clarity on this point because we've received a number of questions. So the restaurants, there will be no orders processed for food or beverage after 9:30. So you can't come into a restaurant after 9:30 and order something new. That would not be available. And if you're in the restaurant and you're finishing a meal, you can't go ahead and order more after 9:30. So if you are seated in the restaurant and you're finishing something you've already ordered, you can stay after 9:30 to finish that meal and depart by 10 o'clock. That we feel is an orderly way to allow the patrons to finish their meal and go. But there will be no new service for in-person customers or new customers coming into the facility after 9:30.
Thank you for that. And we will share if you have a question and answer or something like that on that particular issue or any other aspects of the order as industry segments raise questions, we'll of course share that with our members on the MMA website in real time. There are a couple of questions that have come in regarding funding of particular initiatives, for example, rapid testing for municipal employees, public health nursing, and so on, because of the worry in great part for the end of the use of CARES Act money coming up on December 30th, and whether or not going forward, there will be any resources available for communities to stand up services like that during this time. I know the giant question that the governor and you have in the past addressed regarding whether or not the federal government will deliver something that's meaningful directly to communities and states in terms of relief or a stimulus is still an open question. But in the meantime, is there advice that you have regarding those kinds of questions about testing or public board of public health and nursing services post January 1st?
Okay, so the two parts of the question, first, federal funding, you've addressed that, Jeff, that still remains a question. We are hopeful that there will be further funds available. In terms of testing for public health, local officials, that we do not have a statewide policy on that, partly because of a resource issue, and mm-hmm. partly because testing is constantly evolving in terms of what you're testing for, who you're testing, the ability to process the test in a meaningful and efficient time frame. We are piloting, for instance, a test. It's called the Abbott Binax rapid test, and we continue to evaluate new testing that's available to see both effectiveness and where it could apply appropriately and what situations in our Commonwealth. So that is a work in progress. I don't know if Dr. Madoff, you have anything you'd like to add to that, but I know our medical advisory board, as well as the COVID Command Center, is constantly evaluating testing, new testing, and where it can be applied. That's a general answer to your question.
I don't really have anything to add, Lieutenant Governor. We are evaluating further the use of the Binax now, which is the rapid point of care diagnostic, and expect to roll that out in some other settings as we go forward. And I would just urge again, people can use the Stop the Spread sites and the mega testing site for their employees and for others as well. And that's free and available.
Before you mute yourself, Dr. Madoff, there's a question regarding the DPH dashboard, the daily dashboard, no longer including COVID patient census specific by hospital. We have some local officials who were saying, in this case, it's Mayor Kim Driscoll, that has been a very helpful metric for their regional discussions and planning.
I appreciate that. We have we provide more information than almost any other state. The dashboard alone is into the 20s of pages, and then there's a weekly supplementary report that comes out on Thursdays that has, much more information as well. We can't include everything, but I'll certainly take that back, and I appreciate the comment.
Thank you very much. A couple more questions. There are some comments to agreeing with or different elements of the shutdown order. One local official here is asking for clarification on what the trigger is from going from step two of phase three back to step one. Is that 3 weeks of being read in a row? Is that correct?
That continues to be the way we evaluate it within our metric system. It's 4 weeks of data and three reports determines whether you remain in place or roll back to step one of phase three.
And then how long do you need to be non-red in order to then re-step to step two?
To go forward again to step two phase three would be the same. 4 weeks of data, three reports.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. That prevents the ping-ponging around and provides a database decision. So thank you. There are a couple of questions here regarding cuts to public transportation in a time when we're trying to encourage employees to go back to work in from the community and so on. And so there, we have two people who have just said that they're very concerned about pending cuts. This, in particular, it's the MBTA system, because that would make it difficult, more difficult to reopen the economy, and also have an impact on their residents. Any comments on funding for public transportation during this crisis? You know, the MMA's position has been to support the revenues necessary in order to.
Right. Operations relative to the MBTA, bus service, commuter rail, is done with an evaluation of the data in terms of the usage patterns daily, night, and weekends. And all of that has been studied very carefully by MassDOT to evaluate what service is being used and when, and to trim back where there is virtually no use of that particular service at that time. And balancing those adjustments with being able to provide the service at the times where people are using them, and we project we'll use them in the upcoming months. But clearly, I think everyone recognizes on this call, the future of transportation and the future of work is very much a question. People have changed how they work. While many people remain employed, you heard the secretary talk about unemployment going below 10% now, working from home has become a way of working that is useful to both employers and employees, especially if you are a working parent that has children that are not in school and are in a hybrid or remote setting for their learning opportunity. Makes it very difficult for parents. And the future of transportation, I commute from the West to the East every day. And before pandemic, it could take me an hour and a half to an hour and 45 minutes one way. That is definitely reduced, which is one of the only things I could say is a good part of these pandemic months. But clearly I would take congestion and traffic over where we are now. But where it's all about being evaluated, and we have seen, though, bus service as one that is being more utilized than the MBTA service. And I want to just assure people who are using it that the protocols that we talk about in industry are also being adhered to by the MBTA at a very high level to make this a safe option for people who need to use it. So we'll continue to evaluate it. This is not a perfect process, and it's clearly something that we need to balance the operating budget issues with service levels that are needed.
Lieutenant Governor, we have there are just a couple of questions left. I know we've gone a little bit over. Maybe we can just take those. As a reminder to all of the audience of folks participating in this presentation, in the briefing, we will have a recording of this posted on the MMA website, along with a summary article, and all of you local officials who are on board here are encouraged to share that information with your colleagues in local government. And that way we have an audience of thousands of people eventually for this webinar. So that will be posted on the MMA website along with a summary article. There was a note in one local official said it was kind of hard hearing about the new rules to be triggered on Monday, having them take effect on Friday. I know that you and the administration do your very best to give us, give local officials as much a head start as possible whenever possible. And you did contact the MMA, gave us a notice that the announcement would be coming, and we did post and send out information on this to local officials as quickly as possible. But my instinct is that you felt as though you needed to have these start to take effect on Friday in order to get us ahead of the rise in caseload.
Yeah, clearly, having put the package together, releasing them on Monday, effective Friday, we felt that over the course of this week, we could spend as much time with all of you and your boards of health to educate you. We are available all the time, and we know once this does take effect on Friday, that there will be a bumpiness to the beginning part of this rollout, and we'll work together to address your questions and develop whatever guidance is needed in a place that you can direct people to as well. And our Division of Labor Standards is available to your boards of health as well as DPH to help you make determinations locally. I think what I would say, Jeff, as you get more information from your members, we would like to hear from you what the most pressing concerns are and address them. It could be over the weekend, it could be early next week. We are available, but we want to help you. You are our front line, clearly. Make the best decisions you can. And if we can really work together, as we always do over these next few weeks, we're hoping that we can see some data come through that will demonstrate that our collective efforts are working. This is meant to correct behaviors and have people take our guidance in the issuance of the stay-at-home advisory seriously. We've done a number of things leading up to this point. For instance, sending out emergency alerts on your phone to get your attention. many of you commented that was a very effective tool. Well, we need to keep pushing the message out there that the face covers, the distance, and the hygiene, especially in these months ahead when more people are entering indoors, is so critically important. But we're all in it together. We have to protect each other, and we have to be really diligent about this. So I'm hoping that in the next data review, we always talk about 4 weeks and 3 reports. We hope that we can see some changes here in a better direction, and then we can make some further adjustments. But we can't do that alone.
Absolutely. So it couldn't be said better. There's one town administrator who just put on, you know him well, Mark Hawk, who said the LG rocks, thank you for your efforts. And I think that local officials, not only on this call, but all throughout the state, so deeply appreciate the partnership that's pre-pandemic and during pandemic, and we know post-pandemic, that you have with all of us and the governor shares. So thank you very much. Just as a reminder, as we come to a close now on the on this briefing, that the MMA will post the recording and a summary of this discussion on the MMA website as soon as we can. Also, we will share with the administration any of the questions that we have not been able to get to, and we will receive answers back and send those out with the invitation for the next briefing that will take place on the regular Tuesday in 2 weeks, in 12 days. We'll do that briefing, and then we will of course share, Lieutenant Governor, any questions regarding the implementation of and what comes up regarding the new orders, just as, for example, the restaurant issue came up, and getting clarity. We'll share those with you and then get those responses back to our members.
Okay, so, that's terrific.
So any last words?
Oh, just thank you. Thank you, Secretary Keneally, on the economic development and recovery front, and yes, Making your program so local, really, really important. And just absolutely, Thank you, all of you. I think the governor was a little jealous. He wanted some time with all of you today. And I was really happy that he could share a few words with all of us. That was really important. So thank you. Have a good week. And I know you had a big weekend ahead. So thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Thank you, Mrs. Secretary. Thank you, Dr. Madoff. And to everyone who has made this presentation possible, we look forward to seeing you in 12 days at the next briefing.
Thanks,
Thank you. Bye-bye.